Minnesota. I saw a couple of New Yorkers here.
Yeah.
Really? Good. Good for you. I like the weather. Listen, thanks for everybody. I think just for being you, because you people are the fans of baseball. And just get involved. I had a dad that was like that, but he was a little 5'6". He was a little chubby, but he was a good softball player. Because he could get down easy. But he enjoyed the game so much, and the only time that we had an opportunity to actually go to Sox Park, we had to sit on Sunday doubleheaders. And we would sit right over the 375 mark in left center, when ballparks were that far away. And I'd ask him for an ice cream bar. He says, "You come here to watch the game or to eat?" And he says, plus, when we go outside, there's a place across the street we can get two for the same price you paid in there. And that was in the 50s. But anyway, my job is to shut up, and I try to control these guys. And Rocky Johnson and I worked on a couple of programs for kids, for Blues and Brotherhood, for a long time. Billy Davis was a great player, over to you. And it's good to see him. You know, it's kind of funny because I know him when he was a younger kid, because he's about 4 or 5 years younger than I am. In Minnesota, we had a lot of fun together with the athletes here in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And of course, I know this next guy, Timmy Lautner, and I think I actually watched him grow 2 feet. And he's a sensational kid. He's doing a great job on the television for us now. He's very knowledgeable, and he caught some of the best guys in the game. So we'll try to answer your questions. This certainly isn't something that's going to be down. We're hoping that it's up. We're having a lot of fun. And if you got some questions, the only thing I won't tell you is I won't tell you. And so with that, Tim's got to get back because he's got to go to ESPN. We'd like to just have him talk. And then if you got a couple questions for him, that would be wonderful. And then we'll throw him out here so he can go to work. All right, Tim?
For those of you that came from out of town, and for those of you that are in town, my name is Tim Lautner, and I'm a former catcher for the Minnesota Twins. Now, first of all, there was a question. Suey posed a question that in 1981 I came up to the big leagues. I played at the Old Met. I hit a home run my first day against Dave Rosema. I hit a home run the second day against the guy who would be my teammate in 1987 when we won the World Series, a guy by the name of Dan Schatzer. And I was told that the tied a record set by one Joe Cunningham and from a previous era, and also I think a kid that came up with the Phillies before I, obviously, by the name of Joe LaFay. And my question was, has it been tied since then? And somebody said, maybe. I don't know a lot about Saber Patricians. I had to practice pronouncing it about 10 times this morning. I'm a catcher. I took a lot of foul balls off my face. I have a built-in excuse, and I carry it with me everywhere I go. But I didn't think that you people operated in the maybe. You can get back to me.
John Hopper did. Don't threaten him.
Who's he?
Played for the Giants. I think it was 2009.
Very good. He's in very rare company. Now, I'm just going to be perfectly honest, which is what I do, because for me, walking in here this morning is like walking into baseball's version of True Blood. career too. I don't know. I promise you, I don't know a lot about what you guys do. I really don't. I don't know anything about whips or chains. I don't know anything about OPS or ESP. No, that's FS, and he was wrong. But what I do know is, as soon as I walked into the room, we did share a common denominator. In this world of numbers, we in fact do have a common denominator. And I think it's fairly obvious that common denominator is truly a love and a passion for the greatest game on this earth. And for that, I am so, so thankful and so appreciative that you have, for all intents and purposes, dedicated your life to something that you believe very, very strongly in, as the very athletes that have played long, long before me, while I played, and certainly long after. And again, I thank you very, very much for that. I'll take a couple of questions before I have to, as Frank said, get thrown out of here. I never got thrown out of a major league game. I got thrown out of a minor league game, though. Don't know if you. That's one to throw that out to. You have a question, sir?
What do you think about your alma mater's move to the SEC?
Truthfully, because that's the only way I know. I think it's horrible. And so the question was my alma mater's move to the SEC, which is the University of Missouri. Oddly enough, as I was walking over.
We're from the University of Missouri.
Oh, right. The question was about 1987. Gary Gaetti and I managed to pick off Darrell Evans at third base. Now, if you like, thank you, I appreciate that. We're in the midst of a pitching change. Tom Kelly came out. We're in the midst of a pitching change. Darrell Evans is on third base. I don't know who's on second. And I looked down at Gary Gaetti, and he flashed a sign, open glove. I flashed it back. It was at that point in time that I started to experience my outer body experience. Now, there's more. Prior to that, Gary Gaetti had looked at third base umpire Joe Brinkman and said,
be ready.
So the pitch was blowing in, backhanded, my shoulder was square, I didn't move my feet, step and throw, guy comes to the base, tags Darrell Evans out, Joe Rickman comes running in, gives the out sign, we get a very valuable out in a very, very difficult situation. The next batter, I think, did get a base hit, throw in and run from second, but it saved us a run, and we won a very, very critical ball game in Detroit. After the previous day, former teammate of mine in the last summer Alaskan Collegiate League in Kenai, Alaska, Pat Sheridan hit a home run off of Jeff Herter to beat us by one. So, Raymond gives the out call. Darrell Evans goes to the dugout. Raymond goes back to his position. Gary Batty looks over at him. Raymond goes, "Why didn't you tell me you guys were going to do that?"
Exchange with a home plate umpire during a game.
Best exchange with a home plate umpire occurred 1981, my rookie season. Now, let me preface that by saying, I worked with two, and Frank is going to have to help me here. I worked with two umpires that used the outside pillow. That's how old I am. At the old Met, one was Jerry Neudecker, and the other was a Hallett. Was it Tom or Bill?
Tom.
Bill Hallett, tall skinny dude, used the outside pillow. Couldn't even see him back there. Now, my best exchange occurred. We traveled down to Chicago, Comiskey, to end the season. It was my first experience with umpire, American League umpire, Ken Kaiser. I go out for the bottom of the first inning, and in the midst of the first inning, he looks at me and says, "You got to get lower." I'm a very impressionable rookie. Things have changed, but I was a very impressionable rookie. And so I try to get lower. I go off the bottom of the second inning. Things are going along in the midst of the inning. He looks at me and says, "You got to get lower." Oh, I tried to get lower. The bottom of the third, I go back out. In the midst of the inning, Ken Kaiser says, "You gotta get lower. This is as low as it gets." And he said, "Well, which monitor you should get lower? Butch ain't here."
Together on the road and that kind of stuff like we did. In fact, the mule
which is Don Mincher, saw me and Jeff Sessick sitting after we were punching the pen, and he was feeling pretty good. And he saw us in the restaurant. He says, "Hey, you rookies, let's go. You're going with me." I don't remember things for about 2 days, but he said we had a lot of fun. But that's the way that ball club was. And it was great to see that because, you know, we're critical like anybody, you know, in terms of our teammates and that kind of stuff. And I was wondering if there was that type of camaraderie. And they really had it. And it was really, really tough for them to lose Kirby. He always called me homie. He lived in the projects in Chicago and I was right next to him. And so when he had the end of his life, he really gained a lot of weight. In fact, I told him, I says, "Kirby, you don't have a neck anymore." He says, "That's okay, homie, I'm doing it my way." And he did. And no regrets. But he had an interesting situation in his career when he came to the Baltimore Orioles, and I'll let him tell you a little bit about it. Bobby Johnson, or Rocky Johnson, when we know.
One of the dangers of my coming here is I always wanted to say too much. And it's like the minister on Sunday night realized his car was giving him problems. He needed to get down Monday morning right away to the mechanic and have his car repaired so he could run his errands and that happened to be his day off. He gets down there about 8 o'clock. Mechanic looks at the car and he says, "Take about 4 hours, Reverend. Can you come back at 1 o'clock? The car will be ready." He said, "I'll be back at 1 o'clock. With that, he started walking away and he stopped after about 4 or 5 paces. Did 180, came back and he said, "Boy, by the way, go easy on that bill. You know, I'm just a poor creature." "Well," he said, "yes, I know. I heard you yesterday."
Look right.
One of the things that that when Frank was talking here about introducing a little bit here was I hope what happened to a fellow named Henry Hickenbottom never happens to me. Hickenbottom was a much sought after speaker, after dinner speaker. He was invited one time to the Association of Rural Cooperatives to give a major address, which he did afterwards. A lot of key people came out and thanked him for his message. Pretty soon there's this strange dude looking at him, standing right in front of him. And he says to him, "That's the worst speech I've ever heard in my life. Whoever's responsible for you being here tonight should be kicked out of this association." What's he going to do? Fortunately, the chairman for the evening overheard the comment, came running over to try to save the situation. He said, Henry, don't worry about this guy. He's just the oddball in our organization. All he does is run around and repeats what he hears everybody else say." Here's the question. Who were the 420 game winners with Baltimore, the last 420 game winners? But in 66, when we won the World Series, we had 4 Hall of Famers on that team. Who were they?
Tom Robinson, Jim Palmer, a lot of people forget about Aparicio.
To me, he was the best shortstop I ever saw. When you played first base over there with him, he's throwing from shortstop. you couldn't commit yourself to go out and get the ball too quick because his ball just took off. You know, throw that ball across the seams. So you had to, I had to really make sure that I was watching the ball all the way and I didn't get up and blind myself by throwing the glove off the field. I came out of the diamond in 1954 with a fellow named George Walters. George Walters was the guy they wanted. They didn't want him. And a fellow named George Moriarty. Is that a bell at all? George Moriarty was on the White Tigers. He was an American League umpire. He was a play president. And he was a scout for 20 years. He wanted Walters. He wanted to sign George. But see, George had told that Detroit that if he was going to sign with Detroit, Bob had to come along too. And so it just so happened. That's what happened. That's what the way it was played out. Unfortunately for George, he came up with a bad arm, wound up not being able to play after 1 year. I saw him the first year he was playing in the Class D. He went out there and struck out 7 out of the first 9 guys and couldn't come out in the 4th inning because of his arm bothering him. But they thought he was going to be another Hal Newhouser. And of course, you go back in history, the left-hander Hal Newhouser was something. He was some kind of pitcher. They figured George was going to be the same. George was in high school, was about, I have a 6'3", about 195, 200 pounds, throw the ball through the brick wall. Unfortunately, he started throwing the ball a little too hard in the gym before the season started. And when he came into the pros, unfortunately, he wound up having a bad arm. We thought he was going to be a great, great player. I came out, immediately after high school, went to Jamestown, New York with George. I didn't play there at all because I got hurt in an exhibition game against Buffalo. The first day I was there, they sent me down the path to Paul's Valley, Oklahoma. How many have been to Paul's Valley, Oklahoma? All of you saw down there, it rained twice while I was there. And it was, there were a lot of oil wells down there. But it was an interesting experience. I'm on the bus. Drive going to Falls Valley, Oklahoma, the hotel that I stayed at the night before. And the driver of the bus drops me off in front of this hotel. And he says, so I got my luggage, and there was a fella sitting there in the chair. And I asked him, I said, where's the baseball office? Can you tell me where the baseball office is? And he says, you go up to that city service station up there, and he'll help you. I walked up there, and there's a fellow sitting behind a roll-top desk with one of those hats on with a green visor, and he hasn't looked up yet. And I asked him, sir, can you tell me where the baseball office is? And he said, all he said was, son, you're standing in the back in those days, there was some real, we had some fun. I drove one of the station wagons. Bill Adair drove the other station wagon, and we tried to beat him, and we had to allow ourselves to have him meet us to the Mets, to Crestview Ford, because if you didn't get there before him, you didn't have a nail to hang your clothes on. Believe me, there were nails back in those days. There was a black fella at Crestview that his name was Cobb, and he was part of the Cobb family. But he hit over 400 the year before and presented me with a silver bat that year. And they had another fellow that was on that same team that was a third baseman. And he hit a ball triple one time. And I'm going to give him a fake, like make a quick tag on him, but I don't have the ball. And I'm a rookie. And he gets up and he says, "Give me," he says, "if you ever do that again, I'll cut you in two." But he meant to. I wound up playing with 11 minor league teams and 8 major league teams. I played with Kansas City, Washington, Baltimore, the Mets, Cincinnati, Atlanta, St. Louis, and Oakland. I couldn't hold a job. But there was some real neat experiences during that period of time. 2 weeks ago, I was down in the city. Kansas City, and they had a reunion of the guys that played with the Kansas City Athletics, and that's where I started my season in 1960. Started it against who other than Early Wynn was pitching. Early Wynn had a habit of always starting high. He pitched high because he figured if he swung up here, he probably wasn't going to hit it very well. So he gets 3-0 on him, and then he comes down and throws 2 strikes and he walks, unfortunately. But he was one of the major players, but Hall of Famers that you're going across. We had another. Can anybody? Does anybody know who my roommate was in Baltimore?
We can't hear you.
Who was my roommate in Baltimore? Who was the best third baseman they say in baseball? Brooks and I finished a game in Cleveland. After the game, we walked up to the Kentucky room at the Sheraton Cleveland Hotel. And we go up and we're sitting there, and there's about 6 guys sitting over here at this table. And I can see one guy's collecting the programs. He's coming over. He's going to ask us for an autograph. He comes over and he stands right in front of our booth there, our table. He looks at me and he says, "You're Rocky Pilipito, aren't you?" Yes, I am.
Anybody know that answer?
The answer is I did. DC Stadium, is what they called it at that time. The photographer got the, and this was opening day, and who said, sitting behind the dugout? President Kennedy. And so he threw a couple of baseballs out before we started the game. I just missed one. I wish I could have got that. Well, anyway, the ball comes back in after I hit it, and the photographer who was over by third base takes the picture of me, and in the background is Kennedy, and all his dignitaries, all his cabinet members are sitting there, and they're all applauding Rocky Johnson. And so the photographer says, after the game, I'll have you sign that card for you, and we'll put it on the Washington Post front page. I thought, that's all I could think about the whole game. I'm hitting guys off second, I'm hitting three hits, you know. And about the fifth inning, I look over and there's a big commotion by the dugout. Kennedy's going back to the White House. But I waited too long to get it done because he got them assassinated with it after.
Did you ever face or play with Steve Belkowski?
This guy was a legend in his own time. He was about 5'9", left-hand pitcher. Baltimore signed him. He could throw the ball through the brick wall. He could throw over 100 miles an hour. Everybody heard his arm. And if you get back in those days where you talk about Tommy John surgery, they could have had it back in those days too, but he wasn't around at that time we were talking about. He was, Belkowski could really throw the ball. And unfortunately, he had a slip. Anyway, yeah. Oh, there's a friend of mine. Look at that. Where are you?
Two questions about the 1962 Senators. Number one, Jimmy Pearsall was on the team. Do you have any stories about him? Mm-hmm. And number two, that was the year that Tom Chaney struck out 21 batters in a 16-inning game. Do you have any recollection of that?
I was the only guy that didn't get in the game. I was the only one that didn't get in the game. They had to keep somebody back. And so, in cases that they needed to pitch it or even throw it to pitch a little bit. But Chaney was a good pitcher. He was a little wide. He was wild enough to keep guys honest up there. But he was a good. And then the other one was
Pearsall.
Pearsall was the best I've ever seen at giving you a throw. Where if the ball got in between the outfield and you're out there gonna catch the ball, make a throw to third or something, you could catch his ball with your bare hand, but it was always right there where you needed it to make, get the ball. Two hands, they say two hands. Actually, you don't do two hands, but your hand is in there so quick to get the ball so that you can throw it. Pearsall was a pretty good ball player. He had some funny ideas once in a while. Earl Harmon was one of the announcers back in those days in 1960 when I was, or 61 when I was with Washington. He said, "What if you ever hit a home run, why don't you do something like Pearsall would do? Why don't you come over and run right up to the screen and we'll interview you on the home run?" I hit a home run in Detroit, and as I was rounding third, I said, "No, I'm not going to do it."
Mr. Johnson, you gave me a mic, so I guess they won't be asking questions. You mentioned playing for multiple teams and also multiple minor league teams. I'd actually like to ask you about your minor league experience. Did you find that you were being treated differently by the other players on the team as you accumulated more and more major league experience?
I'm not sure I did.
I mean, was your relationship with the other players the same after several times down as it was when you were first hoping for your first shot?
It was more fun to play in the minor leagues. And I'll tell you why. Because most of the guys were not married at that time, and you hung around together and you roomed together and stuff like that. And then when you got to the major leagues, most of the guys were married by then, and they were spending their time with their families. I did enjoy the minor leagues. One time we were playing, and we had gone to Crestview, Florida, and on the way back we saw a nice cornfield, and we stopped and we started picking some corn to take back and then get to the restaurant. Pretty soon the shotgun went on. It sounds like these are made up stories, but this is what happened. We jumped that thing and then we never stopped them. The minor leagues, I played with Catholics. I started out with Paul's Valley. I went from Paul's Valley to, Idaho Falls, Idaho. And I had a good year there in 348, which was good. And then from there, I went that was Class C ball. Then I went to A ball, rest of Georgia. And I played against Kirk Flood, who played for Savannah, who was a third baseman. He made so many errors that they put him in center field and he became an all-star center fielder. I think most guys are always looking forward to playing in the major leagues, but they do have some fond memories of the minor leagues too. Well, I'll let you go here. I think you've got other people to speak here too.
Well, we could get back, after Billy can speak a little bit about his career. Thanks, Brian. Imagine being in the car with for 20 hours. You say, start talking, Rocky, because I don't want to get bored. But a lot of the guys that spent a number of years in the minor leagues really cherish the experience, and it's something that's really not happening right now. But anyway, I knew Billy when he was a little kid. Yeah, he was about 6 feet. But he'll tell you about his career, and then after that, take some questions, and we'll go from there.
Thank you, Ray. And because you people are statistics people, you know that my major league career and numbers pale in comparison to the other guys in this panel. And most of you don't even know who I am. And I thought maybe what I'd do today is kind of give you a little litany of my journey through my 6 years of baseball, because I think it's more common than not of people who get a chance to play, and then for one reason or another, it never comes to fruition, but it always remains a fond memory. So what I'm going to try to do is give you a little historical travel through the life of Bill Davis as it related to sports and baseball. I grew up in Richfield, Minnesota, which is a first-year suburb just south of Minneapolis here. I went to the University of Minnesota, where I graduated, on a basketball scholarship with the understanding that I could play for Dick Siebert, play baseball. I played 4 years of both sports, and in 1964, my senior year, I was a member of the Minnesota team, the last Minnesota team, to win a national championship down in Omaha, Nebraska. The Chief, well, everybody knows who the Chief is. Coming back from Omaha, I was a free agent because the baseball draft, as you all know, did not start until 1965. So this is 1964. There were a number of scouts and people that have contacted me when we were down in Omaha that were interested in me because I had pretty good numbers in Minnesota, and I played 3 years in the Basin League out in Pierce, South Dakota with some of the best collegians in the country, and had done real well. I was 22 years old. Most of the teams that I talked to were interested in me. The money was not big. $12,000 was what they were talking about. Everybody had the same number. I think that was the first evidence of collusion in the business. But most of them, including the Twins, wanted to send me to rookie league. And I'll relate a little conversation I had with the Twins. Billy Martin was the scout for the Twin Cities area, and Billy liked me a lot. and he wanted the Twins to sign me. So after I got back from Omaha, he called me up and he said, we want to talk to you about signing you. Would you come out to the stadium and meet with us? I said, sure, be glad to. Now, I had no agent. My dad worked for a living. So I went out there all by myself. At the meeting was Billy Martin, Angelo Giuliani, George Groppi, and Sherry Robertson came in. Sherry was a minor league director at that time.
Yeah.
Sherry came in, and it was a long table, and I'm sitting down here, and Sherry sat down there. And he said, okay, what do you want? And I said, well, the money's not important. I said, I want a chance to play. But I'm 22 years old, and I can't start in rookie ball. I want to start in double A. Sherry looked at me and he said, if we send you to double A, they'll eat you alive. I said, well, that's what I want, and that's what I need. I said, I played 4 years for the Chief. I played 3 years in the basic league. If I go down to that rookie league, it does not do anything for me. Sherry stood up and said, good luck. God bless, and walked out. Martin, Giuliani, and Ange looked at me and just went. I got home that afternoon and a phone call from Walter Shannon, who was the Cleveland scout. He wanted to come over, and so we met. My dad was with me, my high school coach. And we went through the same litany. What do you want? Where are you going? I said, I got to start in double A. He said, fine. He said, we got a place for you in the Eastern League where you can play every day. So I signed with Cleveland, and they sent me out to the Eastern League to finish out the season. And I did pretty good. I hit 9 home runs in a league that was a pitcher's league where the leader was hit 15. So at the end, that winter, the Indians put me on their 40-man roster and invited me to spring training. I went down to spring training with a big club, and the first guy I met was Rocky Colavito. He's a lot better weapon than you are. And Rocky had heard about me during the winter conferences and things that they had, and he kind of took me under his wing, and I really appreciated that. And Bertie Tevis was the manager at that time, and he wanted to see if I could play, so I played a lot in spring training. And I had a really good spring. I hit over 400. I had only played a half a year of professional baseball, so they sent me to Portland, Oregon, in the Pacific Coast League. I had a really good year. I hit 311, drove in 106, hit 33 home runs. And at the end of the season, in the September call-up, they called me up, and I had a chance for my first major league at bat in September of 1965 in Boston, Fenway Park. The pitcher was Dave Moorhead. Anybody know what Dave Moorhead did that day?
No.
No, yeah. You know how I did it. I broke with a club. Went to spring training again in 66. I broke with a club. They wanted me to play every day, sent me down in Portland again. I came back up at the end of 66. Hit my first and only home run in September of 1966. It was a walk-off, 10th inning, two-run shot off of Jack Sanford. The only one ever hit in the big leagues. That winter, Gabe Paul called me up and he said, what are you doing to stay in shape? And I said, well, I'm playing a lot of basketball and I'm working out at the U. And he said, well, that's good. He said, because you're my first baseman next year, so come to spring training ready to play. I said, I'll be there. 2 weeks before spring training, I was playing in the Minnesota Amateur Baseball Tournament down in Rochester, Minnesota. And I severed my Achilles tendon. And so I had to make that phone call to Gabe Paul. Gabe, this is Bill. Yeah, hey, how are you doing? Well, I'm in Rochester. He said, Rochester, New York, or Rochester, Minnesota? I said, unfortunately, Rochester, Minnesota. He said, where are you? I said, I'm in the Mayo Clinic, and I'm scheduled for surgery on Tuesday. And so in 1967, I missed the entire year. Cleveland, at the end of that, at the end of 67, took me off the major league roster and signed me outright to Portland. And I went down to Portland, played a long year, did okay, 265, a dozen home runs or something like that. And by this time, I had a rep. I mean, I used to be a dead pull hitter. They played a wing shift on me. Everything from the middle of the plate in, I pulled. And so they tried to bust me in and pitch me away. When I came back after the surgery, it was my back leg. And the first baseman for Philadelphia, who popped his tendon last year in the last game, he's going to have the same problem. You've got the back leg, you try to open up, and that's your pivot leg. And I became a front foot hitter. So I listened to Coomer and talking about how your head moves and all that sort of thing. Well, my head moved, and so it made a difference. So the winter of 68, they sent, I was on the AAA roster. It was also the expansion year where they brought four teams in 1968. And San Diego drafted Zoilo Grisales off of the Twins roster. And later that winter, they traded Grisales in Cleveland for me. So in 1969, I went to the first spring training for San Diego in Yuma, Arizona. You ever been to Yuma? At that time, this is 1969, there was a main highway. And there was things on either side of the main highway, and other than that, there was an Air Force base there, and that was about it. And they had our spring training facilities at the city park, and the clubhouse was a converted swimming locker room. They built the showers in the back. They knocked out one of the walls and built a little wood enclosure and put some shower heads in there, and that was our shower. And I had a good spring in 69, hit five home runs in spring training, and I won the starting job for San Diego. So my one claim to fame, if there is such a thing, for my baseball career was when you're asked who was the starting first baseman for the first game that San Diego ever played in the National League, people will say, Abe Colbert. Well, it isn't. It was me. Now, I'll tell you, I started the first 17 games. We went into Houston, and Preston Gomez, who was the manager, and San Diego was kind of like the Brooklyn Dodgers, or the LA Dodgers South. And Preston Gomez, who was the third base coach for LA Dodgers for years as the manager, pitching coach was Roger Craig, the hitting coach was Wally Moon, and then there was another rookie coach that was just starting out by the name of Sparky Anderson. And the color guy for the radio was Duke Snyder. Pretty impressive. And some of the conversations I had with the Duke are near and dear to me as we were sitting in the airports and stuff like that. He was really a guy then. Anyways, we went into the Astrodome. Preston says to me, he said, I don't let Nate Colbert start today. He said, because the AstroTurf, he's a little quicker than you are, yada, yada, yada. Well, they hit a home run that day. Preston the next day said, I think I'll let Nate play again today. He had two home runs that day. And basically from that point on, I was relegated to pinch hitting duty. The end of May, I was traded to St. Louis, who sent me to Tulsa, where I played for Warren Spahn. That's an interesting story I can talk to you about later. Spahn and I got along personally real good. I didn't agree with him as a manager. We got into a couple of arguments. 6 weeks into the mission to Tulsa, I got loaned to the Twins, and they sent me to Denver, where the coach was Don Hefner, and the manager, Don Hefner, and his coach was Red Ruffing. There's a name I remember. At the end of the 69 season, I hit 290, hit a dozen home runs, and I had a bad leg. I couldn't perform at the level that it was necessary to, that I thought. My wife was pregnant with our first child. I had a job offer in the Twin Cities and a college degree, and I quit. And I never regretted it. Questions? That's my litany. So, any question? Yes, sir.
You mentioned Sherry Robertson. Are you familiar with the unfortunate incident he was involved in?
Other than mine?
No. What it was he had married into the Griffith family, and that's probably the reason he was in the majors. He was playing third base one evening in 43 or 44.
I can't hear you, I'm sorry.
Robertson had married into the Griffith family, and that's probably why he was playing in the majors. It was at 43 or 44 in the evening, night game, and he was playing third base and picked up a ground ball, threw it over the first baseman's head, well into the stands, and hit a guy in the head and killed him.
Frank, I think, knows something about
that. I don't know that story, but, you have to understand the litany of the Griffiths. Clark Griffith was their uncle. The Robertsons were from Canada. And Clark Griffith brought in Thelma and her sister and Calvin Griffith. And they became, but their real name was Robertson. Sherry and the twins, Jimmy and Billy, were all part of the Robertson family. And so, of course, Calvin Griffith actually was a good catcher, and the Cubs offered him a contract. And his uncle said, I think there's a little bit more security on this side of the line. But he did send them to play in Charlotte. And he played in Charlotte, and he managed for a little bit. Then he went back to Washington, D.C., and later, of course, became the general manager, owner, and Sherry was the farm director, along with his brother-in-law, Joe, he married Thelma, and I'll think of it, but it was all in the family, and I can say this for being in the organization for 22 years, that it was really a fun time with all of them, because Jimmy was in charge of the all of the people going out and selling the stuff, and Billy was in charge of the stadium, and Calvin, of course, he was in his, I could tell you a few wonderful stories about him and contract time, but that's the way it was. I never heard that story, but of course, you know, that's one of the reasons my mother would never sit in the box seats. She says, you can't visit with your friends. She says, if all come, probably hit me and kill me. So she'd go up to the mezzanine with all the people from our neighborhood because they did ask for a lot of tickets when I went home.
Any other for me?
Can you talk about your experiences with Bertie Tebbutts as a manager? How was he? What was his personality?
Oh, boy. Bertie Tebbutts. The one thing Bertie did for me that I thought was really neat was in the spring training in 1966, he took me over and introduced me to Ted Williams. And the meeting, you know, I was awestruck, obviously. And Ted, Bertie took Ted, I want you to meet Bill Davis. We think he's got a chance to be a pretty good player. So Ted reaches out and he grabs my hand and he squeezes it. And as he squeezes it, he takes his other hand and he's feeling my forearm. Okay. That was his reaction. Bertie Tebbutts. I played at Cleveland. Bertie Tebbutts, Alvin Dart, and Joe Adcock. Now you talk about three different personalities.
Go Tigers.
I'm sorry?
Go Tigers.
Bertie Tebbutts, if you couldn't hit, he related it to something that your mother did to you when you were a child.
Yeah,
that if you couldn't do something, it was because you didn't go to church on Sunday. Joe Adkai, if you couldn't do something, it was because you didn't do it the way he did. But Bernie was a character, he was a good manager. He became a good friend of mine, but he was definitely the philosopher. Yes.
You were on five different Topps Rookie Stars cars. You never got yourself on a car. Did you ever wonder, what is it like to have my own baseball card to share it?
That is correct. Dave Mona, who I think some of you know here in the Twin Cities, told me one time that I'm the only guy that Cy Burger and Topps Bubblegum issued five rookie cards. And I mean, that's kind of a amazing asterisk in history, but it also kind of is a pretty pictorial summary of my career. Stop. So, yes.
You alluded to some disagreements with Warren Spahn. Would you like to elaborate a little bit?
Sure. Warren was really a good guy. I personally really liked him, but he and I got into some philosophical discussions or the way the game we thought should be played. The specific instance that precipitated my loaning to the Twins was we were playing a doubleheader in Tulsa, and I was batting fourth. The bases were loaded. There was less than two outs. It was the middle innings. There was a right-handed pitcher on the mound, and I was a left-handed hitter. And he pinch hit for me with a right-handed hitter. So, you know, I'm going up to the batter's box, and he called timeout, and a guy by the name of Kiki Rivera was the pinch hitter. And Kiki had this sheepish look on his face as he walked by me to pinch hit. So I went and sat down. And after the game, between the games, I went up to Warren and said, okay, tell me what you were thinking. He said, I had a hunch. Yeah, he said, I had a hunch. Well, Kiki popped out, and we didn't score in the inning that he pitched well. So, fast forward, next game, middle innings, bases loaded, less than two outs, I'm up, right-handed pitcher in the mound. Hang on. He brought him out again. Pinch hit for me. This time, I was not quite as gracious. And Kiki hit into a double play. We lost the game, and after the game, he and I got into it pretty bad. And probably said some things that we shouldn't. And basically, 5 days later, I was on my way to Denver. And that's what it was. I mean, Swanee loved to do batting practice. He could still hit. He was great in the clubhouse, you know, and he loved to tell stories, but he and I had some philosophical differences.
Okay, thank you very much. Oh, I'm sorry.
You mentioned you were stunned by Billy Martin. That's a name that cuts through all three of you. Just your recollections of Billy Martin. Was it the same Billy Martin that...
Oh yeah, it was our Billy Martin that you mentioned became the Twins' coach. The one thing I remember about Billy was that he would come to the University of Minnesota games where I was playing to scout, and he'd stand behind home plate with his scorecard, this big stogie that was almost as big as his hand, you know, sticking out of his mouth. The conversations we had were, you know, basically like a scout has, you know, we like him, blah, 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 blah. But I didn't have a lot of interplay with him, you know, up until that meeting in Minnesota. Yes?
I saw that your last year in the minor leagues, you hit 290, and some of your power came back. Did the Achilles tendon get better? And then also, when you decided to retire, did the Cardinals talk you out of that?
No. When I told Don Heffner that I was going to retire, he tried to talk me out of it, and The tendon was getting better, but I still couldn't, in my own mind, perform at that level that I thought was necessary to get back. When I sent my letter of resignation to St. Louis, because I was St. Louis property at that time, I never heard a thing from them. They never called me. I did have a chance to go to play in Japan. Andy Costco, who was an old twin, Andy called me up and says, I'm going to Japan, and the team needs a first baseman. Are you interested? They were paying $25,000, and it was a two-year deal, and you know, all the bells and whistles would go with it. But I had this job that I started. My wife was within months of delivering, and I passed. And in retrospect, I wish I had probably lived on, because she wouldn't have been pregnant when we were gone for sure. So. All right. Oh, one more.
You played a couple of years. You played in an organization with a very young Luke Pinella. Do you have any stories or thoughts about Luke?
I got a lot of stories, but I don't know if I can share them with you. It was my roommate. Lou had a temper, and you've all seen it, where he kicked dirt on the umpire, take a base out, throw it in the outfield, and stuff like that. The one instance I remember, we were playing in Portland. Portland, if you've ever been to Multnomah Stadium, was a football stadium, and the right field fence was basically just sections of wood fencing. And Lou was the best breaking ball hitter I ever played with. I mean, he could hit a right-handed slider as good as anybody ever saw. But anyways, he got his pitch one day. It was a breaking slider, and hit a hard ground ball on the shortstop, got thrown out. And right from home plate all the way to right field was a string of expletives that I can't share with you. And he was so mad he went out to the fence, and he did a two-footed kick into the wall and ran on the ground. And he's laying on the ground, and he's starting to get up, and the fence section came loose. And as he was getting up, it fell down and drove right back down into the ground. So we ran out there, and we were afraid he was going to be hurt. And he was still swearing. That pretty well did my duty. I'll let that. I said enough. Thank you very much.
And I met Billy in spring training after I signed out of the, we were in the Colorado World Series. And ironically, Rocky, I didn't know this, but George Moyer, he was from Chicago, and he sent his son and a couple of my buddies from our team to Wisconsin. And he came up to me, my dad, he mentioned my dad one time because he met him out in right field. And he asked me if I was going to play ball or what. So he came up and talked to me, and he said, "Son, I can't give you, a professional contract, but I think I can get you into Western Michigan University." And so I thought I was getting a scholarship. And so my uncle Wally had to take me there, and we're driving up to the campus, and we saw these buildings. My uncle says, "What's that building over there, Frankie?" I said, "I think it's a community deal or something like that." He said, "Let's stop there." And my uncle was an inspector at International Harvester McCormick Works in the neighborhood. And so he drives, and he walks into the place, and I follow him. I said, "What's that door?" He says, "Goes out into, nice little grass and all that kind of stuff." So he goes through there. So he goes out there, and he comes back, and he says, "Okay, I did what I wanted to do." Well, we got in the car, and I said, "What was that all about, huh?" He said, "When I get back to the joint," he says, "I'm going to tell the guys I've been through college." It was a wonderful 4 years. Yes, sir.
Frank, I I think that the final game of the 65 World Series was Koufax's greatest game because of the situation, and he didn't have his curveball that day. Yeah. You had one of the three hits against him, and it was a double, the only extra base hit. Would you share your memories of that seventh game?
Oh, geez. You know, I heard the story about him. He didn't have his curveball that day. And when I talked to people about it, and I said, "Did you ever see his fastball?" We did. Great game, you know. Cotton pitched a couple of runs. One was, questionable. But anyway, Sandy was, just such a great pitcher. And his fastball, he could get his fastball to do just about anything he wanted it to do. He could get it to sink in on a right-hander. He could get it away. But when he threw it up here, that ball could actually raise 6 inches. It just blew. And we got Johnny Roseboro, later on with Ron Baranowski. And I said, "What the heck was it like catching?" He says, "I had to stick it in ice for about 4 hours after a beat." And he was one of the most modest human beings, and still is, in his life. He really stayed out of the spotlight. That wasn't his deal. His deal was pitching. And I was always just scared that he might want to come in on me. But I wasn't there long enough. Yeah. Oh, great changer. Yes, sir.
The difference is rather in the speed and the placement of pitches by pitchers of the quality of Sandy Koufax and the average major league.
Today?
Back then?
I would go, he dominated baseball for 6 years. And anybody that faced it, when he had his curveball and his changeup and his fastball going, you just go back to church and pray a little hard. the ball I hit, when you talk about that double, I started the swing before he threw it. I honestly have to say I was lucky, because I was about 155 pounds. And believe me, the force of his ball going to my bat, and I was lucky to keep it going the straight way. But he pitched a whole great game, because he didn't hit the curveball. But you look at him when he's coming in, when they're batting on the back and all that stuff. He was drained, because back then, these guys, they pitched 9 innings, and I know in the first game, I faced on Drysdale, and I didn't get that many hits there. I was hitting the ball pretty good, so Sam left me in the lineup. But I got 2 hits in 1 inning off of Drysdale. And so we won the first 2 games, but then we went to Los Angeles. When we faced them again, he knocked me on my butt twice. And I said, "That's not very nice." Go ahead, sir.
You played before they lowered the... When the mound was 15 inches, then the mound went down, and the facts have gone in 69. So what adjustments, or how was the game for you and for everybody making that, being in that inaugural
change? I enjoyed it on the bench. I was Kilmer's caddy, and he took it seriously, because one day he called me and he says, "You're going with me." I said, "Where am I going?" He says, "To Japan." I said, "I don't like those people." And he says, they were mean to me in the neighborhood. And so he said, "You're going to Japan." We met a bunch of wonderful people. Remember Sadaharu Old? Well, he was a dear friend of ours. And so was St. Aaron. We were all supposed to be there. We had kids from, I think, 146 countries. And they brought in the guys. And Maya Blue was there. What I didn't know is they had the same thing, and they came over from Los Angeles, and they had played for about 3 years in Los Angeles. So when we went there, they had guys that had just retired from the Japanese League, and they were probably in their 30s, and we're in their 50s and 60s, and so they weren't going to get to face where they were. But Vital Blue says, I'm going to show them a big, big fastball. And they smelled it for about 2 innings and then he quit. I just wanted them to not get too cocky. But they had a bunch of good guys at that deal. But Kilgrew, it hurt us so much that when he passed away, he was the face of the Minnesota Twins. And he was always the first guy. When a rookie came out of the camp in spring training, he'd walk up and he'd say, son, my name's Hiram Kilgrew. Welcome to the ball club. We got a bunch of good guys. And he says, and hopefully you'll make the ball club and get a chance to play with them. And he said, good luck. And Bob Allison came behind him and Jim Cotton came behind him. And that was really the Minnesota Twins. It really did become a pretty darn good family. And those things are playing.
My story about Kilgrew, we were having dinner down in the Twins room here quite a while ago, and somebody asked Harmon, why did he decide to quit? And he said, well, he said, when I was in Kansas City, I was sitting on the bench talking to one of the ball players, and there were a couple of kids over there looking around the corner, and they got their programs in, they want signed signatures. So I walked over there and I signed them both, and as I'm walking back to sit down again, one kid says to the other kid, who is that? I said, that's Hartman Kilgrew. Well, he says, is he good? Well, he used to be. Maybe it's time to get out.
You know, we were together. He the last thing he finally found what he wanted to do. And so he became an advocate of the Miracle League, and that's taking challenged kids and building fields for them so that they can come out and play our game. And if you ever get a chance to see one of those, they travel, some of these families travel 50, 60 miles just to play a ball game one day. And they have a buddy, and a lot of times it's a little bit older kid that stays with them. And the fun things that you see watching these kids and getting excited. I almost got ran over by a girl in a wheelchair. And I mean, she was just flying at me, and I was coaching at third base. But Harmon really had a sense that he finally found how he could help, as far as baseball was concerned. And right at the end, about 3 days before he died, they had one out in Arizona, and it's a ground up rubber, and it's so the kids, if they fall on it, they can't get hurt. And a lot of communities are taking it in, and they play a game every week. And he went out there, and every kid gets a base hit, and every kid scores a run. And as they were coming through, Harmon shook it was 141 kids there, and he shook everyone in their hands and wished them good luck. And I spoke to him a couple days before he passed on, and I've got something I'll cherish forever. He signed a note to me, and we were laughing so hard at some of the stuff that happened to us in the last 25 years. And he was just, he was the Minnesota Twins. And, we were talking, I got out of college in 1961, and they signed me to a contract. And they sent me down to spring training, and they said to me, they said, we don't think you got the range to play in the big leagues at shortstop. And I was an All-American shortstop. And I said, what do they call it, cocky? And they said, I can play shortstop. And I went down to spring training. I watched this guy throw the ball, catching the ball, and stuff like that. I said, who's that? They said, Soil over science. I said, where's second base?
My question relates in a way to the camaraderie that you were talking about. At a session we were at on the 65-70 Twins, they talked about the fact that your team was the first team to play in Los Angeles after the Watts riots, and that the white players felt a certain camaraderie and support for the black players on the team. The devastation of the area.
Yeah.
Just describe what that was all like.
You know what? I think color didn't make any difference to us. It's, you know, as far as playing baseball, and of course we had a kind of Antonio Lima, and we had Earl Batty. There's so many great stories about this guy. And, you know, he was such a great catcher. You know, he should have been an all-star every time he played. But when he was finished, Earl went back and got his degree. And he used to come and visit when I was managing in New York, because he was taking New York kids to the Yankee games for one organization, and then when the Giants were in, he would take him to the Giants game, or the Mets, excuse me, the Mets. And so he ended up with a degree, taught for a number of years, and of course, we spoke with him the day before he passed away. Mudcat Grant was his roommate. Listen, we had roommates. And Earl always used to say, because Mudcat, did you ever hear Mudcat sing?
Yeah.
In performance?
Yeah.
And he had Mudcat and the kittens. And the Hudson House did, during the World Series. And I said, Earl, did you, do you know those girls? He says, you kept them away from me. Anybody was. In fact, I grew up with Ron Henry in the minor leagues, who was a catcher from Philadelphia. I used to tell him Polish jokes and he didn't get any. Yes, sir.
How did you come out that you became manager of the Twins, and what kind of challenges did you have?
Kelvin Griffith was the only challenge. You know, it was Billy Martin is the guy that started a lot of stuff for me, because I was working out at second base and it was really hot down there, and he was a scout then. I was taking the double plays and I'm reaching out. And one time I reached out, caught the ball in the glove. And he says, this guy's behind me. He says, catch the ball with two hands, Dago. I said, who the hell are you? He said, Billy Martin, come here. I said, oh, okay. But what happened was, he taught me something that I think you can tell all your kids or grandkids or anything else. He said, listen, he says, you're taking one extra step when you catch it, just with your glove. Because you catch it with the glove, that's one. You take it out of your glove, that's two. You cock it, that's three. And you throw it, that's four. But if you catch it with two hands, that's one, two, three. So when you watch it in television now, you watch some of these young guys that catch the ball with one hand, and they miss the guy at first base. Because either they let the guy get in on them, or they just jump out of the way or whatever, and can't make the throw in time. So, if you ladies, you tell your husbands that.
For anybody on the panel, can you tell us what happened to make 1968 the year of the pitcher? What was unique, if there was something unique? I mean, why did all the batting averages just plummet in 1968?
Question?
Yeah. The question is, 1968, evidently, they thought the mound was lower and batting averages went down that year. I don't know, I had 400 or about 4 weeks. But I don't know. We had some pretty good hitters that year. We really thought coming off of 67 that we were going to go somewhere. But There were really some good starting pitches that year, and so It just happened that way, I guess. And I don't have an explanation for it, other than it was some good pitching. White Sox had great pitching. Baltimore had great pitching.
For decades, Baltimore had great pitching.
Yeah.
You know, today, regardless of whether it's the Little League or the Major Leagues, it's all going to come back to pitching. Pitching, you got good pitching, you got a chance. No pitching, you'd be fortunate to be 500. And so that's how important pitching is today. And that's what the scouts are out there looking at the high schools as much now as even in the colleges, because they get a flamethrower out there and they figure this guy can bring the force. They're going to pamper him and try to bring him into their organization.
You know, I always tell the ladies, you know, their husbands, and most of the gals become baseball fans. They're loyal. As far as the teams are concerned, they listen to their husbands yelp and scream. I said, so when they got their buddies over to have a couple of beers or something like that, and they're yelling at the team, just stick your nose in their ladies and say, it's always going to be pitching and defense. And you're an expert. Yes, sir.
Now, this is for Bob. I was impressed with what you said about how much more fun it was to play in the minor leagues. When you played at Iowa at the end of your career, you were older than some of your teammates. Is it still fun in the same way as it was before you first came to the majors?
When I went down in 1970.
Yeah. So I was still.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. That's the closest time I came to getting hit in the head. Some guy threw one buzz me right behind my ear. Boy, I'll tell you. And I thought, well, Finley, you better get me back to Oakland there. But I had to go back. What happened to me, the change that came into my life that made it possible for me to know that I could play was in 19, after going to playing in 60 at Kansas City, then I was drafted by the Washington team, but I didn't start with them. They sent me to Rochester, New York. Go there, and I'm saying, Lord, I gotta have some help here. If I don't play well, I may never come back. And it's when I was recalled after the first half of the season, I was hitting .332, leading the league in hitting. I had 16 home runs, one more than Boone Powell. I had 66 RBI, 65 runs scored. I got a base hit to beat Boston in the All-Star game. I knew I was going to be the most valuable player that year, but fortunately they brought me back to Washington, and from there I hit .295, played shortstop every day. The next day I went to third base and played hit .288. I knew that I could play. There's a point in a career where maybe there's some concern after going hitting .348 out in Idaho Falls and going down to one of the Georgia teams. And Augusta, and dropping to .232, I figured, boy, that's a heck of a lot of drop right there. So then I started to question whether I made the right decision. But then the talking here, I got better. But there's, when you go out and put forth the best effort you have, good things happen.
Yes, sir.
This is for Bill. Two parts about, can you tell us anything about playing receiver at Minnesota? Why do you think you guys were so good and Northern teams haven't succeeded in the College World Series for so many years? They always say, I assume the weather was cold when you played too in the spring.
The question was, could I relate anything about playing for Dick Siebert and why he was so successful, because the Northern teams, since basically Ohio State won it, what was it, 66 or 67, had basically been shut out of Omaha. I guess the one thing that always comes back to me about Siebert was, first of all, he was a man's man, so, you know, we might have been kids in his eyes, but he had played 17 years of professional baseball. I was a first baseman, he was a first baseman, which was great for me. But he treated us like men. He never looked down at us, never talked down to us. He always was trying to learn. But the one thing that he always stressed was fundamentals. And when I played for him, freshmen were ineligible, so we had the whole freshman year. For Glenn Gossick, there's a name you guys will remember. Goss was his assistant coach, and he was the head freshman coach. And for one whole year, all we did was situation drills. I mean, we went through pickoff plays, pop-up plays, double steals, hit the cutoff man, you name it. And when we got through with freshman ball, we thought, oh, boy, my God, that's not now we can just get down to playing baseball. We got up there, see, we were just bad. I mean, we'd run situation drills. He had his practice, he had his practice basically scheduled. You know, we do batting practice, infield, and then it was always situations. You always had a half an hour, 45 minutes of situations, hit the cutoff man, things like that. So I think that was the thing that made him stand out in my mind. It made me a better player. It made everybody a better player. And when we got, and I think it was part of the success in the northern climate, because when we got up against these teams, Texas, Arizona, Southern Cal, you name it, when we played them, we couldn't afford to make a mistake. We had to hit the right, they had to hit the cutoff, we had to go to the right base, we had to steal. We had to play basically airless baseball, and that's, I think, why his teams were so successful in northern climate. I think also now that you can't play as many games in the northern climate. I mean, when we used to go down to Texas, Texas had already played 15 or 20 ball games. You know, we go down there, you know, we're white as a sheet. I mean, guys were wearing towels over their head because we were getting sunburned, and those guys are out there that look like Greek gods because they had tans and they could play it outside all winter, and we go up there. And we come back and we have to go into the field house at the University of Minnesota. Now the field house at the University of Minnesota is a dirt floor. It's got a running track around it. And then it's got an infield. It had these nets that came down. And there was enough room for an infield and maybe 20 feet behind the infield and two batting cages. And that the fact that we didn't get back black lung by practicing. We would go out, she would come and get us out of class to come and shovel up the infield so that we could play. And we would take batting practice with rubber balls because they would get soggy when they went into the snowdrifts when we were hitting outside. It was a great day.
Say, I just got a notice from the fellows that we got a couple of minutes. I don't know if they have to use this room again. Do they?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. And so we have to call it quits, but we sure appreciate you coming into town.